Mormon Matters Podcast is a production of the Open Stories Foundation and is seeking to build financial support separate from Mormon Stories Podcast. All donations to Mormon Matters are fully tax deductible and go directly towards keeping the podcast alive and towards building a community of support for Mormons like you. To support the podcast or to join the community, please become a monthly subscriber today at mormonmatters.org.
Welcome, everyone, to another edition of the Mormon Matters Podcast. I'm your host, Dan Weatherspoon. A couple of weeks ago, I was shocked to have in the Priesthood and Relief Society manual, which is this year studying the teachings of the prophet Lorenzo Snow, to see a lesson that begins right off with what is often referred to as Snow's couplet or the couplet, which is simply the phrase that says, "As man now is, God once was. As God now is, man may be or man may become." Sometimes I hear it both ways. It's a doctrine that I certainly grew up with. I'm just a little bit over 50 years old, and so it's something that was in the air a long time with me and didn't kind of think twice about it. But certainly I think from the mid-90s on, it seems like it's a doctrine that sort of went underground. I don't know if it was just Mormonism being in the public media. This is certainly one of the divergences with wider Christianity. President Hinckley got involved with Mike Wallace. I hear that they just sort of became friends and he agreed to be on 60 Minutes. And the next thing you know, he's being interviewed left and right. And this is one of the things that people would come up and he would sort of, "Oh, well, we don't really know about that. It's not really theology. It's more of a couplet." And then when people in the church said, whoa, what do you mean? We don't believe that anymore. He kind of assures everybody in a later conference to, "Hey, I know the doctrine, everybody. It's just one of those things that, you know, we're in the public here," kind of, he was sort of speaking code. So it's just like, wow, to have this in an official publication made me say, we have got to do a discussion of this teaching, this idea that human beings and God are essentially of the same stuff, and that the path we're now on perhaps God once was, and that literally Mormons could become gods. And I guess the understanding or the extrapolation from that is do the types of things that the God we worship does now. So it's a big topic. It's a mind-blowing idea. It is, radically controversial, but it does seem to be, at least in those first century and a half of Mormonism, to be quite prominent and lately taking a back seat and now perhaps the resurgence. So I want to talk today with our guests about it as a teaching and its place in Mormonism today. So that's my introduction. I've got three guests. Two of them are familiar to you, and a third one we're bringing in from outside the LDS tradition. I'll just go ahead and introduce him first. Dr. Tom Roberts is from the Greek Orthodox tradition, and many of our listeners will have heard the term theosis, and Eastern and Orthodox Christianity has a long history of at least being a little bit more fluent and conversational with this idea of theosis or divinization or what it means, and in some of our pre-conversation we discussed that we probably both use a lot of the same scriptures. So Tom Roberts, would you introduce yourself to our listeners and just kind of tell us what you do? And welcome to Mormon Matters.
Well, it's a pleasure to be here. I'm the academic dean of St. Elias Orthodox Seminary, and I'm a priest in Christ Catholic Church. And so theology is definitely outside of my wife here, who's sitting next to me, the love of my life. And I got to be careful which order I put that in. But at any rate, I've had quite an ostensive background in Mormonism as a teenager, and I love the people very much. And you would be quite surprised to find how concurrent, you know, my thinking is with many LDS propositions. And that'll be something maybe we can explore as well. I also believe that the difference between the Orthodox view of deification is more one of emphasis, and that Joseph Smith did bring some of his, 1830 culture, in to the discussion at that time, because as we all know, you know, we're culture bound, you know, and we're never going to be free from that. I did a PhD in the area of Eastern Church theology, and my theology has a lot to do with the incarnation and the coronation in the enthronements that is yet to come. And I included a lot of LDS scholars in my PhD dissertation, from sacral kingship to sacred marriage. And at any rate, they're quite amazed to see the modes of thought that we have in common.
Nice. Well, we're so thrilled to have you. You've been blogging at Rational Faiths about some of these connections. I really appreciate that you joined the conversation there, and I appreciate the Barkers who've pointed, you know, introduced you to me. And then also, you did a podcast with Martin Tanner over at Fair Podcast, right? The Fair
That's the correct one.
About these differences and similarities too.
So. That's right. It was April of last year on KSL.
Well, thank you so much, and we'll learn a lot more from you as we go. Now to our old favorites, and one who was on just a couple of weeks ago. I just love having him on here on this topic, because it's like, how can you resist to have the amazing Charlie Harrell join us again? Thanks for coming back, my friend.
Well, good to be back. I'm not sure how amazing this will be, but...
Well, you are the most versed guy I know in the development and articulation of Mormon doctrines. And so with this one, I know there was a chapter in your book where you talked about the Godhead and the plurality of gods, and kind of took this on head on. So would you introduce yourself to everybody again on what the book is and the different things that you do now?
Sure. My name's Charlie Harrell, and I am married with 5 kids, 10 grandkids, live in Orem, Utah, teach at BYU in the School of Technology in the College of Engineering and Technology, founded a software company called ProModel that's also in the area. It's a simulation company, and I am a theological hobbyist, I guess you could say, and have a fascination with Mormon theology and its development, particularly its early development near the during the Joseph Smith era. So I did write a book. It was published last year by Coford Books. It's called This Is My Doctrine, The Development of Mormon Theology. In this book, I trace the doctrines that we generally hold to today in Mormonism. I look at their historical development, how they came to be what they are today, and it really goes back even to ancient Old Testament times. So in this particular topic, for example, I would look at how the nature of God was understood and taught in Old Testament times and New Testament times. And then during the period of Joseph Smith by his contemporaries, because as Tom pointed out, I think to an extent we have to recognize Joseph Smith as being, at least his ideas were shaped by his culture. And then I look at early Mormonism, the later period, particularly the Nauvoo period, and then how those doctrines continue to transform, mutate, whatever, to the present day.
Yep. Amazing. Love the book, and I hope if you guys haven't bought it yet, get out there and go to Greg Coford Books and buy this book, because it is such a great resource. I bring it to church quite often, and everybody's always looking over my shoulder, what's that? And probably sold a few copies for you just from it's my backup in case church gets boring book. But just teasing. But not really, actually. But I don't always. Actually, today I brought it, but I didn't even look at it because today was a good day at church. So anyway, we're recording this on Sunday night for those of you who want to know. But we heard a wonderful laugh in the background there from a favorite theologian of mine. Danielle Mooney's with us again. She really impresses me as a thinker, and she was on the LDS Salvation Practices where we talked about, you know, some of the status of teachings that relate to things like having the call and election made sure and the second anointing. And so she was just this natural person for me to turn to and invite to be on this one again. So Danielle, would you mind reminding everybody a little bit about yourself?
Sure. Thank you. You are so kind. I'm really looking forward to this conversation. I am married and I live in Boston, and I'm working and going to school out here. I'm one of the co-founders of the Mormon Feminist Action Board, and we are currently working on a project to reimagine the young women's theme to include our Heavenly Mother. And so that's kind of how I spend all my time between work, school, and some extracurricular Mormon feminist doings. And then,
what are you going to school for?
I am a French cultural studies major, which means that I'm getting a liberal arts degree in all the classes that I wanted to take, about a odd mix of, I guess, French language and then also African culture, politics, colonialism issues.
Totally cool.
So it's a completely useless degree, but great, I'm enjoying it.
Great angles. I bet it raises questions that very few other people, you know, that unique combination. So you'll come at life differently because of that. So not wasted at all.
Yeah, no. So thank you again. And I'm really excited to have this conversation. I think this is a really interesting aspect of Mormon theology. And I think it's definitely an unsettled point.
Yeah, so. Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah, I hope at the end of this, even though I'm going to be a pretty strong advocate for embracing this particular doctrine and probably one of its more radical formations of it and things like that, but at the end, absolutely, there's no claim that I would make that this is the Mormon doctrine, you know, kind of thing. So I love that you said that was an unsettled question. Listeners, we've decided ahead of time to break up the conversation into sort of an education section first. And Charlie, we've asked you to lead off with a grounding of this doctrine, again, like your book follows, however you want. You can go back to the scriptures, you can go back to contemporary Christianity at the time of Joseph Smith, the Book of Mormon, Doctrine and Covenants, speeches of Joseph Smith. We'd just love to have you take us on a history tour of the doctrine up through perhaps Lorenzo Snow and his ministry. And we'll stop short of discussing where it is today, but I'd love you just to ground it in all that. Following him, we're going to have Tom share with us the Christian take on theosis and divinization. So hopefully the things that Charlie will say will give him some points of contrast and will make it easier for us to kind of catch on to what's going on there. So we'll go to that point. So Charlie, lay it on us, and everybody jump in and ask Charlie questions as we go.
Okay. Yeah, I will briefly give an overview of kind of the origin of this doctrine, in particular the teaching of Lorenzo Snow. And Dan, as you mentioned, there are some contemporary teachings that relate to it. I'll kind of weave those in where it may be appropriate. But historically, we have to go back to May 1836, when Lorenzo Snow visited Kirtland, Ohio. That's where his sister Eliza R. Snow had moved after converting to Mormonism. And so Lorenzo was investigating the church, and he was pretty impressed with what he heard. But he was the kind of person that really needed to study it out, and took quite a while, actually, to join the church from the time he first heard about the church. But in this instance, he spoke with Joseph Smith Sr., and Joseph Smith Sr. said that, kind of predicted that Lorenzo Snow would join the church, and then he told Lorenzo Snow that you will become as great as you can possibly wish, even as great as God. Now, that's an interesting remark, because this stuck with Lorenzo Snow, and he seemed to ponder that idea. And in fact, clear up until like the last few days or weeks of his life, he reflected back on that original saying and remarked that I realize now what that meant. Not that he came to the realization that much later in life, but throughout his life, that prophecy, as he viewed it, had been fulfilled, and he continually reflected on it. So a couple weeks later, he was baptized, and thinking about that statement, he was preparing for a mission to go to England in the spring of 1840. He was still an elder. He was not an apostle yet, but he was listening to an explanation of the parable of the laborers in the vineyard in Matthew 20. It was a sort of a talk, I guess, given by Elder Sherwood. And if you look at that parable, you wonder what in the world that could possibly have to do with, as man as God once was sort of thinking, because it just talks about how different labors would be rewarded the same, regardless, of course, when they started their labor in the vineyard. But he said, as Elder Sherwood was explaining the parable, he said, "The Spirit of the Lord rested mightily upon me. The eyes of my understanding were opened, and I saw as clear as the sun at noonday, with wonder and astonishment, the pathway of God and man." I formed the following couplet, which expresses the revelation as it was shown to me, and explains Father Smith's dark saying to me at a blessing meeting in the Kirtland Temple prior to my baptism, as previously mentioned in my first interview with the patriarch. "As man now is, God once was. As God now is, man may be." Okay, so that was quite an earth-shattering revelation to him. He said he didn't share the couplet with anyone besides his sister Eliza and Brigham Young. He served on a mission with Brigham Young just after that in England. And Brigham told him that he should keep it to himself, and that if he heard the prophet teach it later, then he would know that it's a true doctrine. If not, then you better throw it aside.
Yeah. Don't go on record.
Yeah. So be careful. So when he got off of his mission in January 1843, he mentioned this to Joseph Smith, who said to him, quote, "Brother Snow, that is true gospel doctrine, and it is a revelation from God to you." So that is kind of where the couplet came from, the circumstances surrounding it. But I think to appreciate the significance and impact that it had on Lorenzo Snow and for later Mormonism, it's good to understand a little bit about how God was perceived at that time in Mormonism, which was very similar to mainstream Protestantism of the time. This was not the idea about humans becoming gods, theosis, divinization, deification, whatever we want to call it. That was familiar to Protestants, to Christians of all stripes. In the Old Testament, for example, God is a title that could apply to men, angels, or other beings that God established as his rulers or ministers. In Exodus 7, for example, Moses is made a god to Pharaoh. But there's no mention of humans becoming gods in the sense of creating and ruling over worlds of their own. So there is that important distinction. There are all kinds of, what would you say, degrees or kinds of gods in the scriptures, all the way to false gods, obviously. But one difference, key difference, as stated in Deuteronomy, God is God of gods and Lord of lords. So there's some recognition, and traditionally Christians have viewed the sense in which humans could become gods as a way somewhat inferior than what God actually is, obviously. So most Christians, including Mormons, prior to, say, 1840, viewed the human potential to become like God primarily in the sense of gaining godly attributes of holiness, love, glory, and so forth in the hereafter. An article in the 1830 Preacher magazine, for example, stated that those who become heirs of God are, quote, "filled with all the fullness of God." So they become almost all that God is in terms of his perfections and attributes. But significantly, there was still this ontological distinction between this notion of how humans could become gods and how God is God. There was still a recognition that God was supreme and independent. In fact, in the 1835 lectures on faith, I think this commentary on God is significant. It states, "We here observe that God is the only supreme governor and independent being in whom all fullness and perfection dwell, who is omnipotent, omnipresent, omniscient, without beginning of days or end of life, and that in him every good gift and every good principle dwell, and that he is the Father of lights, in him the principle of faith dwells independently." So a distinction being made here is that God possesses these attributes, these perfections, independently. He didn't get them from anyone. He is inherently good. He's inherently perfect. Whereas anything that humans attain to seems to be, the implication seems to be that they gain that.
Okay, and this was Lectures on Faith, right? You said
Lectures on Faith, right? That's lecture two,
and so that's mid 1830s.
Yes, 1835.
Okay, so yeah. Again, we're going to see by 1843-844 Joseph Smith absolutely changing that.
Yes, and so yeah, the situation or condition I want to try to paint here is that there were clearly two different planes or levels of existence that was seen. One is the plane or level of existence of God, and then everything else, which are creations of God. So it's sort of like he's the necessary being. Everything else is contingent, only has contingent being. And this becomes clear in passages in the Bible, and in particular in Latter-day Saint Scripture, where it talks about the eternality of God, or the eternity of God, simply. Where the Book of Mormon, for example, says that God is not, quote, a changeable being, but he is unchangeable from all eternity to all eternity. An early revelation that Joseph Smith received also refers to God as, quote, the same God yesterday, today, and forever. He notes that, quote, from everlasting to everlasting, he is the same unchangeable God. D&C 109 depicts God as possessing, quote, an infinity of fullness from all eternity to all eternity. Now, I know there's a custom in the church today, largely, to explain these definitions to make them consistent so that we say, well, God always existed, but not as God, you know, that he was an intelligence that developed and grew and progressed to become a God, and that from all eternity to all eternity just simply means from some time in the past to, you know, forever in the future. But clearly the understanding that these passages, and if you were to read these without the understanding that we have today in Mormonism, these kinds of expressions are no different than the Christian, the familiar Protestant expressions of the time. The Lectures on Faith, for example, state that God is, quote, the same from everlasting to everlasting, being the same yesterday, today, and forever. It's interesting, a Protestant declaration in the 1820 states that God is, quote, unchangeable and the same from everlasting to everlasting. So it's the same language, which would lead one to conclude, especially in the absence of any evidence to the contrary, that early saints understood God as being, having been God from all eternity. So again, coming back to the purpose of this is to lay the groundwork or to set the stage for the impact or significance that Snow's couplet had. Interestingly, that in 1840, as late as 1840, which is when Snow received the couplet, the revelation leading to the couplet, there were three LDS pamphlets published, all representing God as being a spirit. One of these pamphlets, authored by Apostle Parley P. Pratt, states, in fact, "Whoever reads our books or hears us preach knows that we believe in the Father, Son, and Holy Ghost as one God." So there's even an element of Trinitarianism still lingering on. He says that the Son has flesh and bones, and the Father is a spirit. A personage of spirit has its organized formation, its body and parts, its individual identity, its eyes, mouth, ears, etc., and that it is in the image or likeness of the temporal or physical body, though not composed of such gross materials as flesh and bones. So this idea of and teaching that God is a spirit, albeit in the form of a man, continued to linger in LDS periodicals on through the late 40s even. Even though in 1841, Joseph Smith first introduced the idea, the concept that God the Father has a physical body, which is in section, 130, where that's
right. Yes.
So that's where we are in 1840. So we have two different paths, one path for God, one path for man. And I think one of the significant phrases that Lorenzo Snow uses in his description, in his explanation, he says he saw what he called the pathway of God and man. All of a sudden, these paths get fused together, and as Parley P. Pratt would later say, state that God, man, and angels are all of the same species. They're not different. God is not of a different kind, only a difference in degree than what man is. Not only there's a shift now in this concept of divinization. As I mentioned, there are scriptures even in section 76 where it talks about how in the celestial kingdom those who are exalted become gods, even the sons of God. But that's also a biblical expression. There's no elaboration given anywhere prior to 1840 on what that meant. There is, however, an accusation leveled by anti-Mormons about what was perceived that Mormons meant by that. And this goes into the teachings of Parley P. Pratt, who in 1837 wrote Voice of Warning, where he talked about the fact that in the hereafter, those who become heirs of God, joint heirs with Christ, as Paul teaches, that they become equal with Christ. And simply because of that statement, there was an article, another pamphlet written by Leroy Sunderland, who said, that's blasphemous.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's interesting that it's almost like the anti-Mormon reaction, or I should say response to early LDS teachings that I think were kind of blown out of proportion a little
bit.
So
like an accidental thing that Pratt would have said it that way, that it would have got picked up like that.
Yeah, that's the impression you get, because there's no teachings that he ever gives, uh-huh, or anybody within Mormonism, that we could, that humans could become gods in the absolute sense.
Well, you get it later with Key to Theology.
You do.
Pratt's going to go and undergo the big conversion to it.
Oh, yeah. In fact, even before then, in an 1841 pamphlet, Parley P. Pratt wrote another in his account to several remarkable visions, where he was talking about the first vision, several other visions that was had. An individual in a pamphlet called Mormonism Unveiled is a pamphlet that Pratt wrote, and that's where he started looking at human perfectionism. And this is another contemporary idea, often called Christian perfectionism, which was, and the Methodists obviously taught this a lot, that humans could become perfect, like God, in this life. But that all that meant was that they were sanctified, that they were disciples of Christ, essentially. So, but that was misconstrued by anti-Mormons trying to blow things, I think, out of proportion. So Thomas Sharp responded to some of these comments by Parley Pratt, saying Mormons believe that they will have power to create worlds.
And that those, really?
Yeah. 1841. So this is really quite early, and that they will have will have power to create those worlds, and that those worlds will transgress the law. Consequently, they will become saviors to those worlds and redeem them. Never until this is accomplished will their glory be complete, and then there will be lords many and gods many. So here you have these anti-Mormons making accusations that clearly go beyond what was actually being taught, at least that we have recorded teachings of. But you almost have to believe that Thomas Sharp, who was an anti-Mormon familiar with the Mormons, he may have heard that being taught somewhere, privately or something. So it just it leads you to wonder exactly where that came from. But on the other hand, you can almost look at it as being planting seeds of thought in the minds of some of these early saints that, you know, maybe becoming like God does actually mean being like him in every sense.
Fascinating thing.
Yeah, so there was a literalistic tendency in early Mormonism, which was not peculiar to Mormonism, but it was seen in a lot of the primitivist religions, where they tended to look at scripture and teachings quite literally. And you see that in some of the scriptural interpretations that they give. And of course, you get, you know, that's where you get the talking serpent or the serpent with legs and all that sort of thing. That it's a literal interpretation of some of these scriptural passages. But this seems to be really taking off with this idea of man becoming like God. As soon as you take that literally, then you have to say, wow, you know, where does that end?
Right.
Why can't we become God in every sense?
Awesome. Now, I want you to continue the story with, you know, now we're up to 1841. Yeah. We're going to start to see it. I wanted to make sure, Tom or Danielle, any questions that you have at this point for this early history? We're basically having Charlie say that Mormons up to this point are pretty much in line with general Christianity. I know we mentioned before, Tom, we're probably using the same scriptures. If we hear joint heirs with Christ from Romans, we probably are thinking of it just the same way and things like that. But any questions that any of you guys have?
Not at this time. It's all pretty self-explanatory. And some of this I've heard, but not in this much detail.
Yeah, it was terrific. And I had no clue that it might. I really felt that funny, Charlie, that it's the idea of going even more literal might have come from somewhere else.
Right.
That's terrific. Danielle, anything else before we have Charlie now take us into Joseph Smith taking a fresh dive here and obviously coming out in the next 3 years with a whole different view of it?
Right. No, I don't have a question, but I did think it was fascinating that the Mormons and their planets cropped up so early. I actually had not realized that as early as 1841, that was something that Mormons were contending with from critics. So,
oh, that's right, because that's one of the big ones today, you know. And
ongoing.
And we'll sit there and go, yeah, well, we don't go explicitly about this planet stuff. Yeah, I guess that's an extrapolation you could draw. You're right. So we're facing the same thing from critics now who want to take it at least more clearly literal than we sometimes are willing to.
Where did the Adam God concept begin to weigh in here that has been so controversial?
1852 in part is like the big year.
Yeah.
Well, and Tom, you can tell us the connection that you see between that and this a little bit later, but okay. So if we're good, Charlie, Here's my dilemma. Tom, are you going to raise the scriptures in the New Testament that kind of provide the theosis divinization stuff? Because if so, we'll just wait for that. Otherwise, do we want to just stipulate, Charlie, that there was something I read in your book on this where you kind of said that when Joseph Smith begins to teach, he will look at some of these scriptures that seem to be divinization, and you don't think it works as sort of scriptural proof texting or things like that. In other words, you don't think that the scriptures mean what he's trying to impose on it. And I guess what I'm trying to establish here is it's probably he's going back for that after what seems to me is he's either having revelation of some sort where he's getting this hunch of the eternal nature of all things. And is this from his teaching with Satius, the guy that's teaching him Hebrew? I kind of want to hear where you think the difference started to really come in.
Yeah. And this was the next point where I'm at is up to the King Follett discourse now, because that's the next major teaching, overt teaching that occurs with this idea, and that's where Joseph Smith appeals to the Bible for several passages. So should I go there?
Yeah, and Tom and I am right. Somewhere along the line, I want these passages to at least be named so we get them in the record. Tom, are you planning that?
Yes, okay. And I think you're going to see that in the Orthodox tradition, they were discussed in the Eastern Church from a long time back in church history.
Right, right. Okay, so let's go ahead and have Charlie finish the Mormon story. So we've been up to 1841. King Follett discourses 1843.
44, April 7th.
Oh, that's right. Okay, it's just a few months before he dies. That's right.
Right. Right.
And so in this next 3 years, clearly Joseph Smith's undergoing some kind of thought. Doubtful that it's Bible study that's driving in there. It's probably something else, right, Charlie?
Yeah, and it's interesting. This sermon, some of the background of it, has to do with the challenge against his people were accusing him of being a fallen prophet, right? And so one of the things that he set out to do was he basically said, hey, if I can teach you new things, things that you haven't heard before, then how can you call me a fallen prophet? So here he's coming along and trying to pull out some things that they had never heard before. And so he says, God himself was once as we are now. So this is where, up until this point in time, we only have Lorenzo Snow's couplet that gives us that first part, that as man is, God once was. People had talked about the idea of man becoming like God in that second part for a long time. So this is where Joseph Smith is dwelling a lot on the first part of that, saying God himself was once as we are now and is an exalted man and sits enthroned in yonder heavens. I'm going to tell you how God came to be God. We have imagined and supposed that God was God from all eternity. I will refute that idea. It is the first principle of the gospel to know for certainty the character of God and to know that we may converse with him as one man converses with another, and that he was once a man like us. Yea, that God himself, the Father of us all, dwelt on an earth the same as Jesus Christ himself. You have got to learn how to be God yourselves and to be kings and priests to God, the same as all gods have done before you, namely by going from one small degree to another, from a small capacity to a greater one, from grace to grace, exaltation to exaltation, etc. So Elder Snow is obviously elated to finally hear this being taught from the mouth of the prophet. In fact, his son said, who actually had his copy of the Times and Seasons, he had his father's copy, said that that particular sermon was marked up more and highlighted more than any other teaching, any other verse or passage or teaching in all six volumes of the Times and Seasons that his father owned. So that was significant and vindicating for him. So one of the things that he points out when he says, we suppose that God was God from all eternity, he said the scriptures inform us. So here's where he draws scriptural justification for it. The scriptures inform us that Jesus said, as the Father hath power in himself, even so hath the Son power to do what? Why, what the Father did. The answer is obvious. In a manner to lay down his body and take it up again. Jesus, what are you going to do? To lay down my life as my Father did and take it up again. So, he's paraphrasing the scriptures, and it's actually a combining of two passages, one in John 5:26 and John 10:17 to 18. I don't know if these are passages at all that Tom might be referring to later. I almost doubt it unless he's familiar with Joseph's use of them, because they really have nothing to do with us becoming like God. It's more of a pronouncement about God himself once having lived on an earth like Jesus did. So, interestingly, John 5:26 merely states, for as the Father hath life in himself, so hath he given to the Son to have life in himself. And then regarding Jesus' power to lay down his life and take it up again, John 10:17 has Jesus saying, I have power to lay it down, and I have power to take it again. This commandment I have received of my Father. So there's no implication there that the Father had power over death that he used in some eternity past to resurrect himself. All it says is that just as the Father has power in himself over death and power of life, he said that he gave Christ that same power so that he could use it in this case to resurrect himself. So could it be read into that? Yeah, by some stretch you could get there and say, well, you know, the Father may have done something like this, but it's certainly not explicit in the passage. The second passage that he cited as proof by inference that God was once mortal is John 5:19, that says, the Son can do nothing of himself but what he seeth the Father do. For what things soever he doeth, these also doeth the Son likewise. So Joseph Smith gave his own version of this passage, saying, what did Jesus do? Why, I do the things that I saw my Father do when worlds came into existence. I saw the Father work out a kingdom with fear and trembling, and I can do the same. So, interestingly, John 5:19 doesn't actually state that Jesus did what he saw his Father do, but he says he does what he sees, present tense, the Father do. It's the idea, basically, that most New Testament exegetes would say this means is that Jesus is simply operating in concert or in harmony with the Father through the Spirit, as it also says in John, the Father that dwelleth in me, he doeth the works. So it's this indwelling relationship that the Father and the Son have that guides the Father's actions. Mm-hmm. That seems to be the sense. Though, again, it can be, you could stretch this into that kind of an interpretation.
Yeah. Now, maybe you're going there, but right now you're not in the ballpark that I think is the key difference that came out in the King Follett discourse. For instance, what you're doing here is what I think, as I read those passages in your book, you're saying, yeah, Joseph Smith is using these scriptures, but they don't have to be taken that way. And so you've kind of gotten us through that section. But to me, it's the God finding himself in the midst of spirits and glory saw fit to institute laws by which that is to me the fundamental difference. And so somewhere between 1841 and 1844, or who knows how long ago, you know, I that's why I was kind of teasing you a little bit about, you know, his Hebrew lessons. I can't remember the years for those or whatever. But somewhere a long time ago, he began to have the sense of no ontological difference between God and the rest. Everything is uncreated. Everything is co-eternal with God. And so that what you have is a God that is simply, you know, if like you use the Lorenzo Snow pathways, parallel pathways, God's just ahead on the path and, you know, and has through modeling this pathway himself has, you know, called forth other spirits in glory, their spirits with their own self-existent, you know, principles to come together and give it a try themselves if they want to. They're free to keep going all the way. So that's where I want to, like, because I think that's the key distinction between the Mormon teaching and what we're going to learn from Tom.
Okay. Yeah. Let me, one more quick point on this has to do with there being what we call an infinite regress of gods is a sermon that Joseph Smith gave about a month later that we call the Sermon in the Grove, mm-hmm. where he referred to Revelation 1:6, which talks about God being, it was like he was praising God, John the Revelator was, and saying, glory be to God. He said, Revelation 1:6, he called it altogether correct in this
sermon. Oh, that's right. Yeah, I remember.
And he interpreted it as a reference to both God the Father and to God the Father's Father, because the passage said refers to God and his Father. And the accepted translation of that is actually referring to, okay, Joseph Smith said that clearly there exists a God above the Father of our Lord Jesus Christ from that passage. But the better translation is probably unto his God and Father. So referring to Jesus as God and Father. So it's a little confusing there, but it's kind of what that Father refers to. Does it refer to God's Father, or is it simply God the Father, which is the way most people understand it? And interestingly, that's the way that Joseph Smith understood it in the Joseph Smith translation earlier. So this is where you get into some of his Hebrew, where he starts interpreting Elohim as the gods, as plural. And early in Joseph Smith's teachings, and early scriptures reflect this as well, a singularity of God, a very monotheistic sort of theology. But then as he starts developing this idea of humans becoming as gods and that there is a plurality of gods, he started reading a plurality of gods back into a lot of the same passages that he saw monotheism before.
Right.
So, and that's one of the examples. Now, the other one, though, that you're referring to has to do with, and I like what you state about it, that it sort of suggests that there is an ontological unity between God and man by the fact that we are all intelligences. We were all intelligences, uncreated, and that Joseph Smith said God found himself in the midst of intelligences, and because he was more intelligent, he provided a way, a plan, so that they could grow and progress to become like him. One interesting thing here is that today we typically associate the gods in embryo concept with spirit birth. And what we say is that because we are literally spirit offspring of heavenly parents, by implication, it is our destiny to become like God. We have that potential because we are his children, literally. Now, that passage or statement by Joseph Smith that God simply found himself in the midst of these uncreated intelligences, and then he decides to provide a plan for them and organize them and let them have the opportunity to grow and progress to become perfected forms of intelligence, if you will, then that almost suggests that there is an inherent commonality or ontological similarity between humans and God, more so or more fundamental than that derived just by being literal spirit children of heavenly parents.
Yep.
So, yeah. Any other questions or comments at this point on where we got, how we got to the validation of the couplet, which some people will still balk at
right.
And say that, well, maybe we don't have the exact teachings of Joseph Smith, but the fact that he's got two sermons where he talked about it and in other teachings as well, and he was quoted by others as having taught it. It is interesting, too, that in the book of Abraham, Joseph talked about God being, he talked about intelligences existing one above the other.
Mm-hmm.
Until you come to God, who is more intelligent than them all, or in other words, he's the greatest. So you have a cap there. Now, this is 1842 at the latest, but then you go on to the later teachings in King Follett, and people were saying that what Joseph was teaching at that time was that gods exist, or intelligences exist, one above the other until there is no end to them. So this pathway concept that there are these intelligences just progressing along this pathway doesn't seem to allow for an ending to it. It's like, you know, this one eternal round sort of thing. It's the, if you could hide a kolob, you know, there would be no end to race or to gods. That was at least the sense in Joseph Smith's era. That's how his associates understood his teachings.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, well, I think you've done a great job of, like you say, bringing us up to the validation of the couplet, and we have the historical development there. Anything, Danielle, on just where do you see the significance of this, and what did I name it where you would also draw the line as far probably what is going to be the most significant difference between us and at least between this particular flavor of Mormonism or this particular take of Mormonism and wider Christianity, and that would be in the uncreated nature of everything, therefore no ontological difference?
Yeah, I think that, and then also really critical difference is the plurality of gods.
Which opens to feminine and other things. Is that what you're leaning towards there? Or just the number?
You know, not even opening the door to including the divine feminine, but even simply with, you know, the patrilineal line of heavenly fathers extending back through eternity is something, you know, that Joseph covered and in this sermon in the Grove, and is something that you see continue to have play in Mormonism, in particular through Brigham's Adam God doctrine. And I think that that's another point of significant disagreement with a broader Christian world.
Okay, good. Tom, anything? I'm going to be turning to you real quick for a presentation of the Christian stuff and bouncing off this, but any clarifications that you might have? And then, Charlie, I'll give you one more chance for anything that you left off that you before we turn over to Tom. But Tom first, your questions for Charlie?
Yeah, there's a couplet in John that a lot of modern scholars are now saying the gospel's emphasis is that we emulate Jesus. Okay, then Jesus does the same works as we do, which is the same orgon or works that the Father does. So what it ends up with is we all image each other as we go up the line to Godhead. We're seeing more of this in Roman Catholicism and some of their writers, too. So a lot of things that you couldn't really discuss in 1830, you know, aren't so taboo anymore with Scott Hahn's writings in Rome. Then you have, you know, the movement of where everything in creation, you know, grows, the Whitehead theology of process. And isn't it interesting that very few people link Joseph Smith with process theology, yet a link can be established?
You need to read my dissertation, Tom. That's what I did.
Well, you'll have to send me a copy.
Cool, I will. Anyway, yeah, you're right. Process theology and Mormonism, it really is pretty similar. Lots of various.
And they hit on both ends of this, I think, too. I think this point Tom's making, not only of our ability to become like God, you know, in some fashion, but also bringing God down, and that's a poor way to state it, but, you know, to a human level, at least, of understanding, where God has passions. You know, he doesn't necessarily know everything absolutely. He's not this absolute being as in traditional Christianity. Is that right, Tom?
What we have in the emerging church and some of the older Orthodox writers is a definite plea towards open theism. And once, of course, open theism is established in the academic world, then all the rest of these discussions are at least possible.
Right. And it's been neat. I don't know if you've been aware, but the Society for Mormon Philosophy and Theology over the last 5 years has often had open theists come and engage with Mormonism.
Yes, that, so. I've seen it on Mormon Fairs and other LDS publication. I think it's awesome because in my doctoral dissertation, I quoted in 12 languages that man is the offspring of God, and even pulled from Protestant publications from Princeton Process Theology in their journals from 1977, July, showing that we should have translated many more passages as such.
Terrific. Well, good. So I want to turn the time over for you to kind of like start at the beginning, however you'd want to present this throughout the history. But was there anything specifically when you're talking about the John passage and whatnot that you were going to try to draw a quick response from Charlie from?
Not specifically.
Okay. And so, Charlie, is there anything left in your presentation here that you want to do now? Otherwise, we'll just go right to Tom.
Yeah, it would just kind of bring this couplet up to date, roughly, just the fact that throughout Lorenzo Snow's life, this was a signpost, a guidepost for him. It was he called it a star that guided his life, and thought that was just almost like it was the most important theological concept that he ever grasped in his life, and just latched onto that and let it be a guiding ideal for him the rest of his life.
Yeah, I remember the lesson really mentioning that over and over again, the one in the manual that kind of got me thinking about having this topic.
Yeah.
And I think that'll be a place where when Tom later, I'm going to invite your critique of the Mormon take, that I think what Charlie just said there about, you know, does it have the practical value, the pragmatic value of this teaching versus one where humans and gods are separate species versus the same species? I want to deal with the pragmatism of that. And I think what Charlie just said is sort of saying that pragmatically, this really motivated Snow, whether or not it's true or not, it at least raised his sights about his potential.
Yep.
Thank you for joining us today on Mormon Matters Podcast. To discuss this podcast with others, please check us out at mormonmatters.org. To keep this podcast alive, or to join our support community, please consider a tax-deductible donation today at mormonmatters.org. Music for this podcast was brought to you by Brittany and Clayton Pixton. The Mormon Matters logo was generously provided by StudioCase.com. Thank you for listening.
All is well.